Hello, ladies and gents, boys and girls. After a long delay, we finally here. We start out on our journey through the pages of South Indian history. First off, please accept my apologies. This was due 3 months ago, but work kept me fairly busy and I just couldn't find the time to get it done. But I now hope to get out one episode out at least once a week, and if not, at least one episode every 2 weeks. So without much further ado, let us begin. This week, we will be laying down the groundwork, understand the lay of the land and how it affected the power dynamics in the region, how the ancient South very broadly ran its own economy, what natural barriers afforded them both protection and, of course, a barrier to their own invasions. Because after all, one man's mountain is also another man's mountain. And before we move on to the history of South India, it is important to understand the geography of India very broadly. Indian empires have, through the centuries, have had a fairly clear pattern of existence and later collapse. You would broadly have the three main empires, one each for Uttara Bharatam, which is North India, Madhya Bharatam, which is Middle India, but centered around the south, typically what would be modern-day Karnataka today, and Dakshina Bharatam, which is your South India, but in this case, South-South India. Each one of these powers constantly jockeyed for power and position and, of course, access to mineral wealth or rich fertile soil, but status quo was mostly maintained. The Narmada was usually the natural border between Uttara Bharatam and Madhya Bharatam, the Kaveri between Dakshina Bharatam and Madhya Bharatam. Of course, as always, you have exceptions to the rules. And on occasion, a super state would rise up and rule over at least two of these entities together. But except for maybe the Mauryan Empire, and mind you, I'm saying maybe because we do not have any specific evidence that the Mauryan Empire actually conquered or even vassalized the extreme south, but let's go with the flow and say the Mauryans and the Mughals under Aurangzeb has any one empire till the British actually ruled over all three Bharatams combined. Not to worry though. This is not some abstract concept, and we will be tracing the rise and fall of major empires, but primarily through the prism of the Madhya and Dakshina Bharatam rulers and empires. Whenever an Uttara Bharatam power intervenes, quite rudely most of the time, into Madhya or Dakshina Bharatam, we will definitely then introduce them, talk about them briefly and understand why they did what they did and how the South reacted to whatever it is that they did. Now is a good time as any to explore the question, why have even the mightiest North Indian empires failed to invade and capture the southern extremities? Or to the contrary, why have very few southern empires managed to actually capture and rule the north? Well, this is tied deeply into the geographical question, and this is a good way as any to introduce this question, introduce this topic. For this, let us just for a moment imagine you're a North Indian emperor planning an invasion down south. And this could be at any period till the 19th century when rail networks totally changed the face of logistics and thus warfare. In this hypothetical example, you are a rich empire centered around, say, Pataliputra. I'm sure I'm mangling that name, but please go with the flow. Or let's just say Patna, it's easier. You muster your armies and start marching. Your first barrier would be the Narmada and the Son rivers. Now there is a land bridge, a small gap in between these rivers, but then this is located smack in the middle of Dandakaranya forest. More on the Dandakaranya forest in a minute, because that played a large role in why the south and the north were fairly isolated from each other except for trade links. So you have to take the direct route. But crossing these rivers in the monsoon season was ruled out, as they would be in spate. And shallow crossings and bridges would be challenged. And these are through known routes, so you really can't fight your way through. So you would have to plan the invasion for summer, when the rivers would be at a low and you could cross easily. But then, summers in the middle in South India, as you might be fairly well aware, can be very brutal, with food not very easily available for foraging soldiers, as harvest would have been called in and the fresh batch of crops for the next season not planted yet. So this is a fairly troubling question to start with, but let's assume you somehow managed to figure out a time and place where you managed to invade, you had access to food, you had access to water, and you still pushed your way through. So let's go with the flow. But then you come across a thick belt of forest that is to this day called the Dandakaranya Forest. Once again, my apologies, my pronunciation might not be accurate, or I'm sure I'm mangling these words, but please just go with the flow. The forest of Dandaka was a large swath of thick forests in ancient India. Today it is centered around Chhattisgarh, but deforestation has reduced its geographical extent, and back in the day it was much, much bigger. It's mentioned in the epics, both the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, quite extensively, because again it was a big barrier for Rama to cross even. It is said to have stretched from the Vindhya Mountains in central India to the banks of the river Krishna and Tungabhadra in the south. Project this on a map of India and you would see this forest run literally as a belt around India's middle. Mind you, this was not just an uninhabited forest, which itself would be a fairly challenging trek to make and to clear. But as our epics both make clear, the fierce tribes inhabited this forest, so that any would-be invader would have to both traverse through thick forests, full of dark and unknown terrors, well, to an ancient soldier at least, and then fight through the various fiercely independent tribes that inhabited this forest. But of course, you're ambitious, you're strong-willed, and you push through, losses notwithstanding. And then you finally break into the Deccan Plateau. Well, for all you trivia lovers out there, the name Deccan is itself an anglicized form of the Dakshin or Dakana, which itself comes from the Sanskrit word for Dakshina, which we've covered extensively now, which means south. So, there you go. Dakshina, south, Deccan. That's how the link is. The northern reaches of the plateau are relatively less fertile and during summers, and to this day, see extremely hot temperatures. It was and it remains rich in minerals, and many a ruler, both from Dakshina Bharatam or Uttara Bharatam, have eyed this, and this region has been the site of many a conflict and even the graveyard of many a powerful empire like the Mughals under Aurangzeb. But let's just assume you push through, you push again, and you finally get to the rich Kaveri Delta, or you take a small left or right and you reach the spice coasts that were famous for their wealth and the exports of spices. And you finally have reached Dakshina Bharatam. But record scratch, hold it right there. While you did this jaunty march, large powers from the middle and south of India would be contesting you all the way through. So in addition to natural barriers, you had large armies to fight through. Not an easy task. Simply put, the distance from Delhi to Tehran is just about the same as the distance from Delhi to Gangaikonda Cholapuram, the capital of the Chola Empire, for example. In the north, though, if you managed to secure a few key passes, the terrain was more conducive to offensive operations, especially for cavalry, whereas the south, it was just not the case. So northern empires tended to trade with the southern empires, but active invasions and open warfare, except for the exceptions which we've spoken about, not so much. Now let's leave the emperor aside and move on. In the south itself, the terrain and geography lent itself differently to each culture and drove their economies and societies differently. Starting from the south, extreme south, the Tamarakam kingdoms and empires had access to both the rich and fertile riparian delta of the Kaveri, which was and to this day is extremely fertile. They also had access to trade, international trade, that is, mind you, via key ports on the Bay of Bengal. Pumpuhar, Tuticorin, which exists as a port to this day, Arikemedu, Mamallapuram, Nagapattinam, Kulachal, that's Kolachal for you, which is another port that the current government is planning on establishing. Korkai are but a few of these famous ports that find mention in many ancient records, be it Roman, Greek, or even Arab travelers. From our own Sangam records in Sangam period, it is estimated that the eastern coast of what is now called Tamil Nadu had no less than 15 to 16 such major ports. So as you can see, ancient Tamilakam had both rich, fertile soil for agrarian activities, access to mineral wealth, thick population belts with higher population density relative to that era, and finished luxury goods of that era, and ports with which to trade with the outside world. It was a fairly self-contained geographical entity. The Chera lands, roughly modern-day Kerala today, were fantastically rich thanks to the spices and the elephants that they exported. Fun fact, every major South Indian procured their water elephants from what is now Kerala, and they basically then fought each other with the same set of same elephants that they procured from the one source that was known to produce elephants, water elephants. In fact, elephant training is still an art in Kerala today. Of course, it's not as vibrant, or it's not as wealthy as it used to be when you had to supply half of the continent, subcontinent, for war, but, well, what do you know? The Chera lands also had their own major ports, one of them being Muziris and later Kozhikode, once Muziris fell thanks to a massive flood in the Periyar River. Of this, Muziris definitely deserves more than just a mention, as the port was a key to the trade between South India and initially the Phoenicians, the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans, the Egyptians, and Arabs later on. It exported spices, primarily black pepper, which again Kerala is known to do for this day, pearls, which mostly came from Sri Lanka, diamonds, sapphire, ivory, and if I had to guess, because there's no specific evidence, but in my opinion, elephants as well, because elephants was always a key Chera or Kerala land export. Chera Nadu wasn't as fertile as Tamilakam though, for the most part, and had to depend on its neighbors for food requirements on the occasion. Moving north from modern day Tamil Nadu and Kerala, you come to the Madhya Bharatam powers. These were mostly centered around Karnataka, and on occasion Andhra, and on very few occasions Orissa. Now, these guys controlled the belt of the middle India. They also, like Tamilakam, had access to rich river deltas and had soil conducive to grow spices as well, and they had mineral wealth both for consumption and exports. However, there's a slight catch here, because primarily the export trade was routed mostly via the ports in Tamilakam or Chera Nadu, as the all-powerful Shrenis or guilds, and more on them on a later episode because they definitely deserve their own episode, control the export trade for the most part and centralized it out of ports in these two kingdoms, Tamilakam and Chera Nadu, for the most part. That being said, the fertility of the Kaveri Delta was unmatched by the lands in Madhya Bharatam powers, and this would also be the root of many a conflict, an ancient and medieval version of Lebensraum, you could call it expansion space, however you say it. This is the general lay of the land and a very, very macro, very high altitude look at how the region was set up. Each of these topics, say the economy or specific empires, would be looked at into much detail over future episodes. I hope you enjoyed this, and next week we will start out with the history of South India with the Sangam age in Tamil Nadu, which is where our true records and recorded history of this region begins. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.